Ah, yes. Thursday in New York City. New York is abuzz. Tribeca Film Festival launched last night. We're going to be talking about that. I had the pleasure of going and seeing some incredible bands live. And yes, the movie, by the way. Yes, that's right. Tribeca Film Festival shows movies. We're going to have a lot of clips, a lot of conversation about that. And we're also going to be talking about Aaron Hernandez. Unfortunately, he hanged himself yesterday in a Massachusetts jail. You remember him, former tight end for the New England Patriots. Sad, sad story. But not such a sad, sad story to say, bye-bye, Bill O'Reilly. Go sit on the sideline of the remorse side of the playing field for you. I'm sure he'll come back in 2 years and write another book about remorse, right? We're going to meet an author in a few minutes that wrote a great book about data. We are data. Algorithms and the making of our digital selves. It's really scary, right? The footprint that we leave everywhere we go. You know, you log on to your Google account. Next thing you know, you see the pair of shoes your wife was looking at or the tool you wanted to buy from last week. How are they tracking us? How, I ask. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Always appreciate your input. 888-874-4888. 888, make that 874-4888. Of course, email is mark@markfarrellmotivation.com. I got an email the other day, actually, about the last week's show that there's a guy from Pennsylvania. I actually can't find the paperwork right now. But he commented very positively on my positivity. So I really appreciate that. You know, hey, I'm just like everybody else. You know, I can't stay bright and shiny all the time. But, you know, I love life, even though I've had some bumps in the road, just like us, like we all have had. But I do my best. But I appreciate the feedback. And always give us a call and weigh in on any of the topics we're going to be talking about today. Again, 888-874-4888. So last night, I had the pleasure of going to the Tribeca Film Festival. And the actual opening night was at Radio City Music Hall. So unlikely, right? Unlikely source or venue because you're thinking Tribeca. Well, what has happened is I actually have outgrown it opening night. And it's kind of neat because it shows that obviously, to refresh your memory, De Niro started this after 9/11 happened. He figured we need to have a way, a conduit, an attraction to bring people and businesses back to Tribeca. And in 2002, he created the Tribeca Film Festival. So 16 years later, it's thriving. And here's a piece of De Niro last night.
Thank you, Governor Cuomo. Welcome, everyone, to the 16th Annual Tribeca Film Festival. 16. That's approximately 15 more than I ever thought we'd reach.
Amazing.
He did a great job last night. He was only upstage on stage for a few minutes or so. And that was fine because, you know, he doesn't need his event, but he's not the star of the event. Of course, it's always fun to see him. When I arrived, there was all red carpets on the side of Radio City Music Hall and paparazzi. And inside on the jumbo screens, you could see all the who's who and, of course, De Niro. And the last night opening performance was for Clive Davis. Obviously, music mogul, obviously, you know, spending half of his life or more than half his life, 50 plus years in the music business. He's just an incredible individual. So they showed a documentary last night that was based on his autobiography, Clive Davis, The Soundtrack of Our Lives. And it was incredible. It really was. So it started out again with De Niro opening the event, saying some nice words. Cuomo spoke. I made some funny jokes about why he went into politics and why Bob, his friend Bob, that would be Robert De Niro, went into acting. So it was tongue-in-cheek, and it was well done. And then I had the pleasure of sitting there for about, I guess, 90 minutes or so to see this incredible movie directed by Chris Perkle on Clive Davis. And, you know, I knew a lot about Clive Davis, I thought. But the behind-the-scenes footage and the stories about how he founded Janis Joplin, his meetings with Bruce Springsteen, and I've read Bruce's latest book, Born to Run, which if you're into music, you don't even have to be a big Bruce fan. I highly recommend it because it really sheds insight on the inner workings. And I think this is really, really pivotal because, you know, the first of any big movement is huge. Rock music, whether it's disco, whether it's autonomous cars. I mean, all these things happen, and there's always a first, and there's always movements. But to have the capability to survive in a business for over 50 years and to have an ear and to be able to identify fresh new talent and to reinvent them and know what will work and what will not work for them is really remarkable. I mean, to have that talent and power like Clive Davis possesses, it's just really unheard of. So I'm going to be talking more about the movie because I just really want to share that with you. But I also want to let you know what happened after the silver screen got pulled up. Barry Manilow hit the stage. And it's ironic, actually, his timing, because he just announced that he was gay. Yes, I know. We're still in shock about that. 2 weeks ago. So I wonder if that was very interesting timing, because I'm going to stitch this together for you in a few minutes. But Barry Manilow mentioned 2 weeks ago that he's gay in preparation possibly for this performance. Hang on the edge of your seat to find out why. Jennifer Hudson performed. Dionne Warwick. She is so very regal. And I don't know her age. She's got to be like 78 or so. Incredible. Still has the range. Earth, Wind, and Fire was incredible. Carly Simon was there. All I can say is I was so psyched to see Carly. And I'll get into this in a few minutes. But she was something's not right. I think she's experiencing some mental health issues because just wasn't right. That's all I can say. But it's going back to Clive Davis. So Clive Davis discovered all these people, an incredible amount of talent that I mean, it would take probably 5 minutes to list all the people. But it's very interesting, his start. Raised in Brooklyn, Jewish family, and he was either told go into entertainment or be a lawyer or a doctor. So he said, okay, I'll be a lawyer. You know, I don't know anything about law. So he went to law school, graduated, went to law school, got his law license, JD, and started practicing. I think about a year or two in when he was at this firm, I got a call from somebody from Columbia Records. And they said, hey, how would you like to work for us? We have somebody who's leaving, et cetera, et cetera. So he said, okay, you know, I'll come over. You know, again, not having any experience in the music industry at all. But as an in-house attorney, that's what they're called when you're an attorney when you work for corporations, in-house. So you're an in-house attorney. And, you know, he's kind of liking it. And then he gets a call from the then president saying, hey, listen, we're going to put you in charge of the, I think it's called like the music and operations division, which literally they showed footage of instruments being built, shipped, contained, you know. So he's like, okay. So before this actually happened, the president calls him back again. Said, no, forget what I just said to you last night. We're going to make you the head of the A&R division. And he's like, can I think about it? So basically he thought about it and said, okay. So that was how he got his start in music. Serendipitously. I mean, this guy didn't have an ear, never played an instrument. He listened to radio and he watched TV with Mitch. What's that guy's name? Mitch Miller. And actually, Mitch Miller was one of the prized golden boys of Columbia Records. And Mitch is the one who always would tout that rock and roll was dead. It's never going to exist. It's never certainly going to have a future. And Clive was like, I disagree. So one of Clive Davis's first assignments, I don't know if he was assigned this, but they said to him, hey, listen, why don't you go out to Monterey to the music festival? So they showed his footage of Clive Davis, a Jewish guy, you know, with a white collared button up shirt, pants on, no jacket, but very business looking in the middle of this field where everyone's just freaking out. Janis Joplin is on stage. And I don't remember the name of the band that she was performing with. She wasn't signed at that time. She was virtually an unknown. And they show him mesmerized, and they do cutaways of him speaking about how utterly blown away he was with her voice and her magic ability to paint pictures and to just transport you wherever you were into her, like, Janisdom, you know, just this realm of air and magic and story, fables, and just life tales of living on a road and drugs and sex and ecstasy. It was great. So he came back and said, I have somebody we have to sign. So he brought her back very shortly after that, and they show him in the studio, and she was very uncomfortable with the whole corporate world, as you can imagine. And he is so convivial and so genuine that I can't say he cajoled her, but she trusted him, and he saw enough in her where they signed. And I can't make, I'm not making this up, I swear this is the truth. She said to him, listen, I think this is such a great thing. We're a family now. So I think we need to consummate this relationship and all sleep together. It's great. He's like, well, you know what? Janice, I'm flattered. I'm really flattered. But I think we should keep business aside from pleasure. So Clive Davis's first offer to go into the sack with a musician was with Janice Joplin. It's great. So the movie just goes on and on. It talks about Bruce Springsteen, how he brings in his first material. I think it's Greetings from Asbury Park, his album. And Clive Davis says, you know, I don't hear a single. And Bruce is like, you're right. So it's great the way he just connects with artists. And again, starting as a lawyer and weaving his way just by a happenstance, a windfall, into a seat that he was able to flex his muscles. So this kind of intrigues me for many reasons. Number one, I love music. I like history as well. But also, it goes to the point that I like to speak about a lot here on the show, and also in my live talks when I speak at schools, colleges, and organizations about, you know, putting yourself out there, taking chances, doing things that you've always wanted to do, whether you dream about them, you're intrigued by them, whether it's a hobby, whether you're just, you know, shaking in your boots, you're too afraid, and understandably, to make a career change. But, you know, here's somebody who's been in this business for over 50 years. He's 85 years old, 85, and he still goes to the office every day in Manhattan because he loves what he does. And they were showing the, or speculating on the secret of success for him. He was saying that every weekend he would take every charted artist that wasn't on his label home and listen to it and figure out what made that person successful. And also to make sure that he wasn't missing anything, like a new sound, a new angle, or why this musician in particular was successful. And so I really think, and this was made clear in a film last night, that again, the name of the film was called Clive Davis, The Soundtrack of Our Lives, based on the autobiography. So maybe you want to read the autobiography first. Again, it'll probably be out. I'm sure it's going to be picked up, and maybe it'll have a short run in certain artist-like movie theaters throughout the country. But if not, I'm sure it'll be available for digital download in the next 3, 4, 5 months. But he was much a businessman as he was kind of like a father and friend figure to so many giants. When you have P. Diddy, Janis Joplin, who else? Whitney Houston, which we'll get into in a few minutes. Jennifer Hudson, Barry Manilow, Carly Simon, Aretha Franklin, all these people just saying that this man is the only suit they really trusted. And so everyone got a really good chuckle out of that because he is just more than somebody who wants a hit record. He wants you to have a good time, to be safe, to enjoy what you're doing. And if you're not comfortable doing something, he would say, here's what I think we should do. And if you don't agree, we don't have to do it. But just know that here's what I think we should do. So that was very, very intriguing because so many aspects of what he did in his career were very, very commendable. And there was one or two turns in his professional career that went south. It was very interesting. He brought Columbia up to the multi-million dollar record. I mean, he just received an award, and then the next day he got fired. And he said it was age. That's what it was speculated in industry. And then it found out that someone in the company at Columbia was forging his signature, and monies were being stolen and misallocated, and they knew that he wasn't behind this. And he was vindicated about that. So for 2 years, he was on the sidelines. For 2 years. Incredible, right? After he signed all these major artists. And then all the music industry, musicians were standing up. Artists were very pissed off and venting their and voicing their opinions about how Clive Davis is a stand-up guy, upstanding citizen, etc. This is not true. We're not going to tolerate it. So all this media backlash, and actually a judge rendered a decision, basically saying with all the documentation provided, he had seen nothing in his entire career that lacked less evidence than this particular case. So he was exonerated. But he said something very, very interesting, which will lead into maybe some other headline stories that we're going to get to later in the show, that it was nice to be exonerated. But the exoneration and the headlines that follow that are minuscule, minuscule compared to the headlines of presumed of being guilty, presumption of being guilty, I should say. And he's right, because you think about this. I mean, say if I was walking out of the studio and I got my car and I hit somebody and they said, oh, Mark Farrell, you know, ran somebody over, blah, blah, blah. And they think it's it was up to nefarious activities, et cetera, et cetera. And then they find out maybe 2 or 3 months later, of course, yeah, toxicology came back. I was clean, whatever. But it would never come out as saying, you know, Mark Farrell did everything right. He was following the traffic rules, et cetera. Bad example. I know it sucked, but whatever. but he's right. You know, the negative headlines always get the bigger, bold print, and the retractions and or the follow-ups are not usually as big as that. So it goes on to talk about all the different musicians that he was very, very close with. And Barry Manilow, Jennifer Hudson, he found certainly after she won American Idol, Dionne Warwick. I remember when Dionne Warwick is in a film and she talks about how she felt that she was done. And then Clive went up to her once and said, you know what, Dionne Warwick, you may be done with the music business, but the music business is not done with you. And she utters those words on stage. And that's pretty cool because it just shows that, you know, he had a capacity. Sure, he was interested in, I'm sure, in the bottom line and making money. But again, his love for music and his nuances, how he was connected to mixes. Kenny G, they tell a great story about Kenny G. He records, they show Kenny G actually on like Canal Street opening his rain jacket and like handing out his albums and going like, hey, you know, check out my album, et cetera, et cetera. And so they do an album with Kenny G? I'm trying to remember. So Kenny G makes it. He's like doing like incredible, like instrumental albums. Like Clive Davis would write to record companies and say, or radio stations say, hey, listen, trust me, this is going to be a hit. But no instrumental song at that point had ever gone on to multiple formats of radio. And of course it took off. So then Kenny G tells this great story about how Clive Davis said to him, listen, I think we should do a Christmas album. Kenny G looks at the camera and says, I said to Clive, I'm Jewish. So it was really fascinating. And he said, Clive said, listen, trust me, I will be right. I am right about this. You do not have to do this Christmas album. Not because you're Jewish, because it's your right not to do it. But if you don't do it, I will tell you that you'll make the biggest mistake of your life. And if you do do it, you'll see there and reap the success, the benefits of it. So P.S. Kenny G does it. It's amazing. It's amazing. And Clive wants to put some vocals on it. He wants to put vocals on it. Kenny G resists. He resists. And so, I mean, I can't tell you how many albums it sold. Like, over the moon. Very, very successful. So Kenny G approaches Clive Davis and said, Clive, now, can you look me in the eye and tell me that I was right about not having vocals on the album? Look how many sales we have. And he said, Kenny, I can't look you in the eye and tell you that, because if there were vocals on it, I would have sold even more. So it was great stuff. Really, really good stuff. You know, it was just amazing to hear that. All these great artists. And by the way, I have to tell you a great Kenny G story some other time. I recorded him twice in my former role at another radio station, and it was very, very interesting. But here's a great little intro from Whoopi Goldberg that tells a great story, and enjoy this.
You need to stand and face earth, wind, and
so they're making their way to the stage. Earth, Wind, and Fire. Maurice White. I forget the other two guys' names. And they're hanging out. And this comes on. Woo! Chills, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is Insight. My name is Mark Fowler. Show on, let me start that all over. I've been up since 4 o'clock. I got home at 1:30 last night. So give me a little slack here, please. Let's try that again. This is Insight on Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. 21 minutes after the hour, 11 o'clock in New York City. Hope you're having a great day so far. Check in with us at 888-874-4888. We're talking about the opening of the Tribeca Film Festival last night, Radio City Music Hall. All the great stars who were there, and the great movie that was shown, Clive Davis, The Soundtrack of Our Lives, new documentary at the Tribeca Film Festival that's making its debut by Chris Perkle. Clive Davis started as a lawyer. And so his career made many, many moves. So long story short, I was telling you about how he got fired. And then he was brought back. They actually made a phone call at the last hour because the media was just dogging Columbia's name through the mud. And they call up Columbia, or Columbia calls up Clive and says, I think we should talk. So he came back. They were worried about him. They fired him, essentially, they never said this, because he was making too much money. When he came back, he actually owned more of the company. So those two people who actually fired him initially got fired. So long story short, it goes to Arista Records. After that, he gets fired again, goes to Arista Records. But he's very, very crestfallen, because after his name was dragged through the mud, and after he was falsely accused of allocating money, misappropriation of monies, etc., he lost. He was disbarred. And he was very, very torn over this. And I think this speaks volumes about his personality, ethics. The high ethics and morals of Clive Davis. Because a few years later, when he was reinstated in Arista Records, he started all these different divisions and was bringing a lot of different artists over and had an agreement on who they can bring and what he can do. He would go home after his long, arduous 12, 14, 16-hour day. You know what he would do? He studied for the bar. Was he using his license as a lawyer? Was he practicing law? No. But he had something that was taken away from him. And he didn't like that, because as a young man in sophomore year in college, his mother died. And that was the closest person in the world to him. A year later, his father passed. So he had all this loss. So I think that's another thing that kept him the devoted, the steadfast professional music icon and mogul that he was and became and still is. Because of his fear of loss, he didn't want to lose anything. So this was his way and form of just holding on and pursuing success. It wasn't even, I don't think, the monetary aspects. It was that he could impact people's lives and trajectory. So that loss of his law degree, being disbarred, took him very personally. So he got his law degree back. Did he ever practice it? No. Practice law? No. But it was one way of saying, you can't take something away from me that I have control of. And that, I think, speaks volume. So we're going to meet our guests in a few more minutes, but I want to play you one more clip from last night from the Tribeca Film Festival at Radio City Music Hall. By the way, 6,000 people in there. It was a who's who crowd, great looking crowd. Well dressed, very, very lovely, beautiful people. And here's Whoopi Goldberg, who did a great job in between acts of Killing Time. There was no script, and that's a tough gig, man. She's emceeing. I've done it before. She doesn't even have an earpiece. You can tell she's just looking over there to make sure the band was set, etc. Great house band, but, you know, she's just making up stuff on the fly. And as a comedian and an actress and movie star, she's good at it. But, you know, in a live event like that, it takes a lot of talent. And here is her introduction of the Queen of Soul.
Sort of encompasses everything. She won 18 Grammys. She landed 100 songs on Billboard's Hot R&B Hip Hop chart. She was the first female to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Her hits resonate around the world to this very day. And every day, somewhere, someone is singing one of her songs. No one owns a song quite like she does. She has consistently been voted the greatest vocalist of all time. Of all time. So it's not enough to say that she's the queen of soul. It's not enough to say that she's insanely blessed because she's got it. She is another icon. And we are lucky to be in this room with Clive Davis and the one, the only, Aretha Franklin.
You getting chills yet? Hang on. Here comes the Queen. Center stage.
I need everyone to go.
That's the usher.
What a pleasure it is to be here tonight with you. You came a long way to be with you. And Mr. Davis, for so many years, it's been a real pleasure, and I am honored to have been an artist of his and to still be an artist of his. What a wonderful, caring, caring humanitarian. He's not only the chieftain who sits in the executive office and takes care of all of the business, he takes care of his artists as well.
Talented Aretha Franklin. I mean, what a great event last night. Again, that's opening night at Tribeca Film Festival, Radio City Music Hall. Pick up his book if you haven't already, and stay tuned for the forthcoming documentary to be released. I hope you enjoyed the, you know, me talking about that, because I just think it's kind of an era of music, multiple actual eras of music that he was really responsible for. I mean, when Barry Manilow got up on stage and he looked like his face could not smile because it would be cracked because his plastic surgeon just did way too much work. But anyway, with Jennifer Hudson, Dionne Warwick, Earth, Wind & Fire, Carly Simon, who was just really not herself, but still it was great to see her up there. It was just a phenomenal, phenomenal event. And it's just a great reminder of, you know, what we can do in life, what our capabilities are. Our limitations are boundless, you know? I mean, so seize the opportunity. And speaking of seize the opportunity, I want to talk about something very, very important to us, because all of us, especially if you're listening on your digital device, are susceptible to your digital footprint, of course. So my next guest I want to introduce to you is John Chaney Lippold. He has written a great new book, We Are Data, Algorithms and the Making of Our Digital Selves. This is very, very important because, you know, we as users of digital devices, whether we're at work, whether we're at home, we're obviously all over the internet. And we're being followed. We're being traced. Our algorithms, our footprints, they know who we are. We know our demographics, how we shop, how we buy, what we avoid, et cetera, et cetera. And what does this hold for our future? John, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mark. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. I hope you got a good listen for Aretha Franklin. She's just amazing, huh?
Oh, she's wonderful. To hear her is just a pleasure.
It really is. And I was remiss in saying very quickly that she lost 200 pounds due to her pancreatic cancer, and she looked amazing.
I did not see her.
Yeah, amazing. Anyway, as assistant professor of American culture and digital studies at the University of Michigan, you know what you're talking about algorithmic identity. And before we go any further, please define that, because we certainly want listeners to be totally, totally crystal clear about this. So because we need to understand the implications of what we're doing online.
For sure. Our algorithmic identities are these interesting data profiles that exist in multiple databases around the world that tell us a story not of necessarily who we are and who we want to be or who we identified as historically. It's who governments or advertisers or even police departments assign us to be. And so for me, the reason of writing this book wasn't that we're profiled, because everybody knows that, not that there's surveillance, because everybody knows that, but what are the actual constitutive effects when something like gender or something like race or something even like citizenship is assigned from an algorithm instead of assigned from, are you an actual U.S. citizen or are you a foreigner from the United States?
Interesting. Obviously, that's very, very popular nowadays, ubiquitous, I mean, to talk. And it's a valid, valid concern, because with our new administration, you know, we don't know what's in store.
Yeah. And just to be really quick about that, the bill that Trump signed into law earlier this month was a big giveaway, I guess, to the telecom companies. But for me, it really signifies the real need we have to push back against surveillance and also kind of argue for privacy. Because usually people say, okay, when you're traveling around the internet, a company like Google is watching at most 25% of your traffic.
Wow.
But the bill that was proposed by the Republicans to roll back FCC rules and eventually signed by the president, that gives ISPs the ability to more or less collect 100% of your data. And then using that 100%, they could sell that to a plane travel agency or a hotel booking website. And then that site will then know how much you can really pay for a plane ticket. So you might see plane tickets for $30, $40 more dollars than other people, just because your data suggests that you can pay more.
Wow, that's fascinating. So this bill obviously has vast implications. And when would it go into effect?
So that's the thing. Now that the rollback happened, companies can start right now. But the big thing that a lot of, especially with, you know, as we've seen with a lot of these big companies, they tell the government, you don't need to regulate us because we'll self-regulate. We will do the work on ourselves in order to get away from governmental, you know, overseeing. So they have the ability to, though Comcast and Verizon and a bunch of other ISPs have very publicly said that they wouldn't do anything that would violate individual privacy, which is, you know, selling individual counts, selling individual people's data. Rather, they're just, you know, giving collective aggregate information to different marketers. So that could be happening right now. We don't really know because it's hidden, and the entire auspice of the law was that they're removing the opt-in clause for participating in this wide data surveillance thing. So now you have to opt out of every single individual ISP, and that's often more burdensome, but it's also almost impossible because sometimes you can't find the button or sometimes you don't know that it's happening.
Hey, John, do you think this is sort of a give-and-take endeavor because the internet's still free, so this is something that we're going to have to just deal with?
You know, I'm back and forth on this because a lot of sites have yet to find a really good business model for what the internet looks like and how to, you know, hire a bunch of my colleagues who are, you know, writing blog pieces or writing op-eds for different newspapers. At the same time, though, I just think that the move in the late 1990s, early 2000s to fund the internet with advertising is, and we have to keep on reminding ourselves, that advertising is a regressive tax on products, because if Tide sells a detergent to somebody, they're going to have an advertising campaign of maybe $10 million. That $10 million is not going to be eaten by the company. It's going to increase the price of the product. And so while we think that these you know, advertising, you know, based sites are free for us. They're actually hitting us in a very indirect way when we actually go to the newspaper stand or we go to the grocery store or the pharmacy. So right now it's a give and take, but I think right now we're giving much more than we're able to take.
So it's interesting because you introduce a whole nother aspect, the psychological subliminal aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Which obviously there's been a ton of research on that aspect, but in terms of online, I imagine it just translates as well in terms of the unknown aspect. But, you know, you're familiar, like, for example, so I'm 6'3". I'm looking for new shorts. You know, hey, it's spring. I want to get some new ones. And I went on, I think, Gap or somewhere. So next, you know, I'm rolling through my social media feeds, and they're everywhere. And especially, you know what's interesting? The one or two pair that I clicked on that I liked because they're longer shorts, they're the ones that keep popping up.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, they have this to a science. They want to show it to you in very intentionally discreet ways. So it's not just...
It's not discreet.
You, with, you know, you should buy these shorts, rather that it's a... You know, we know when people are more likely to buy it. We know when they're ramping up to do it. Amazon is a genius at that. They actually created an algorithm that they patented that would actually send send books or whatever things that you were going to buy on Amazon to you before you actually purchase, because they'd understand how you went about doing your online shopping, and then it would send it from the warehouse before you actually clicked, with the assumption that in 99% of the times you would actually click buy later, 6 or 8 hours after the fact.
Wow. Is there any way to bypass this?
So in terms of the give and take, I'm a big proponent of understanding that any asymmetry of information that exists is it reduces the ability to have democracy. I think for being a citizen of the U.S. or being a citizen in any democracy, we have to have a sense of privacy where we're not affected by the state, we're not affected by commerce. We can really just deliberate and understand who we are. When we have an asymmetry of information, when a bunch of people know information about us, but we know nothing about them, the problem of actually being who you are, being, you know, a citizen, being somebody who has thoughts that are independent of any other external forces, really, really difficult. So there's a really important strategy that I like to think of, which two NYU professors wrote about in a book called Obfuscation. It's saying that normally, statistical models, algorithms, they take data not as I understand what is important, but they say, we're going to try to find patterns in your data. So we're going to find the signals in the noise. And so through that, with big data and with the ability to, you know, have 100% of your traffic be at least mined by ISPs, that is giving them a sense of signal. So what would we do in terms of obfuscation is actually generate random queries every 6-8 seconds that is searched upon a bunch of different sites, and then make the surveiller, make the data veiler think that all of those are authentic, real searches, which then confounds the fact that there's a signal in the noise and just makes everything noise. And then through almost chaos, we're able to exist in a more free space.
Can you email me what you just said? Oh, my God. I think I actually wrapped my head around that. That's amazing. How much research it took for that conclusion alone, man. Wow. That's incredible. So I guess I was going to – my next question, John, was going to be, you know, can you create an alias? But I imagine if – so if I have three computers at home, which I do, and this could pipe – pop up what my example from before, looking at shorts on any computer or whatever my wife is looking at. So I guess it wouldn't matter if I made a fictitious account, et cetera, just so when I'm shopping, I can go in there, because the ISP is all going to be the same. So the traffic and the footprint's the same, correct?
Exactly correct, yeah.
So that's a moot point, I imagine.
It's a moot point, but like, there's fascinating white papers. A lot of business companies who do this kind of work, they are trying to be transparent enough in order to make people not feel creeped out. So there's one company in particular, I'm not going to name their name, but they have a white paper that shows how even if you don't have an alias account and you have 5 people or 3 people or 6 people using the same ISP, the same IP address, the same MAC address for each computer, they are able to find out the signal in the noise of 6 different people using the same computer of each of those people. So if you have a family, it'll be able to understand that even though it's coming from the same computer and the same IP address, that there's 6 different individual discrete individuals that are participating on that computer, and then they can market and profile each and every one of those.
Now, how would they know that? Because they know how slowly Mark Farrell types?
You know, and that you joke, and that is 100% what they're doing.
Really?
It's how you move your cursor. It's there's even algorithms that suggest that how you move your cursor tells what kind of gender you are.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
That is crazy. So what's the difference between male and female genders in terms of cursor movement?
That's, for me, that really hits the heart of the point of the book, which is that really it's not about gender. And one example you can have your listeners do is Google, what gender does Google think you are? And in 2012, they released it, so Google was able to give you a sense of who they thought you were. And if I go to my page, it says I'm a 65-year-old woman. And that's,
well, you look damn good, John, for being a 65-year-old woman.
I really appreciate it. You know, I do. I do what I do. I eat healthy.
There you
but
go.
It's because being a woman online is not about being a woman in patriarchy or being a woman in terms of getting less money. It's having your browser patterns match a certain profile template or having your cursor look in a signal way. Like there's enough signal that these women do that suggests that that's a sense of how women use their cursor, that it doesn't matter if you actually fit or don't fit in the gender formation in the real life, but if you fit the data, then you're going to be a woman, or I'm going to be 65, or I'm Facebook. You can actually check this too. They have something called affinity ethnicity that tries to assign you an ethnic identity without necessarily you saying who you are. I'm Hispanic in Facebook world, but I'm completely Danish in real world. So to think about questions of white supremacy or racism or structural prejudice, to think about questions of patriarchy, we're losing really the vocabulary to talk about these very real lived experiences when categories like race or gender or even class or sexuality or if you're a citizen of the U.S. or not, completely detached from the historical context and repurposed for the, you know, for what we would call the ontology of data or the life of data.
Now, with all this different noise happening algorithmically, with the big companies mentioned, Facebook and, of course, Google, is there room enough for other companies to be doing this with you, and how would they fight for control of your information?
So there's several companies that are trying to do privacy-centered search engines, privacy-centered social networks. The big problem, as a lot of sites have seen, there was a social network called Elo that came up a couple years ago that was trying to be a big, you know, anti or alt Facebook. But there's a social network effect that unless all your friends are moving to another site, you're not going to be able to, you know, leave Facebook. Or unless somebody is going to be able to put the billions of dollars required to do a huge infrastructural project to recreate Google, but without the requisite, you know, tracking and surveillance implicit in that. The capital costs are extraordinarily high, so really what we're dealing with are monopolies in the digital world. And with the move to letting ISPs join this $83 billion industry, which is online advertising, the idea is that there's possibilities for alternative companies to exist, but really we haven't seen any, even though the public and the consumers are desperately wanting them.
Wow. It's really frightening. Did you get more and more, I don't know, awestruck when you started to delve into the research of this book?
I was on two things. I became kind of immune, and I don't want to say that in a flippant way.
No, sure.
But it was the way that, like, you know, and also part of my book, I talk about privacy. Is like privacy is something that, to talk about gender and race again in class, it's, you know, as a white guy, I haven't had to deal with a lot of the privacy issues that people who are not of my identity have had to deal with for centuries. So I've always been a little bit kind of like accepting of privacy as something that I take for granted. It's a luxury commodity, as one scholar has said. But at the same time, I see just how almost brilliant these engineers are. The computer scientists who I talk to and the project managers I talk to, even though I might not agree with the actual processes that they're doing, the way that they're doing it is beyond genius, which is at the same time problematic as well as, you know, kind of like, it's engaging. I hope I wrote the book in a way that makes you feel not sympathetic to these companies who are trying to control their lives, but at least you appreciate how much just extraordinary intrigue went into all of these processes. So the ability to see if somebody's sexuality through somebody's face, I think that's there's an algorithm that tries to figure out if your face suggests if you're gay or straight. The fact that people have that, I think, is ridiculous. And
it's sad state, sure.
It's horrible, but there's the fact that people are able to create that is, for me, it's intriguing from a scholastic perspective.
I can see why. It's very fascinating. With all these different companies and with the new legislation that was passed, I don't know the nuances, et cetera, but do you see the potential for maybe a class action suit in the next 5-10 years or maybe even sooner for people being invasion of privacy or mischaracterization of race, sexuality, et cetera?
That's a really good question. In terms of the first one, class action against invasion of privacy, the FCC law more or less gives, in very vague language, cover to the ISPs. And so unless there is a very, you know, explicit privacy violation of somebody buying your ISP browser history and then selling it or maybe blackmailing you, like that would be something that would then be give the ability to make a class action suit, in my mind. In terms of misidentification, that happens all the time, and I'm actually I like it. And that's not to say that I like being tracked, but I like the fact that Google thinks I'm a 65-year-old woman because it means that Google's not smart enough yet.
And also, you're the first one to know about sale on Depends.
Yeah. So I can tell all my older friends that all these things are happening.
Now, John, I bet you didn't think we were going to be talking about Depends today, did you?
It sometimes creeps up.
We are Data, Algorithms, and the Making of Our Digital Selves. This is the new book from John Chaney Lippold, who's an assistant professor at the University of Michigan. Where do you see things evolving or devolving in the near and or distant future?
I see the move towards personalization being the big thing, and I also see the move towards us finding ways to have non-surveilled spaces where you pay like a $20 a year fee. I think those will become much more probable and existent when people kind of really consider what privacy is and how it's important to daily life.
How safe do you think they would be, John? Because everything it seems is hackable nowadays.
Everything's hackable, and I will never say anything's not, but I do think that, you know, through encryption and through a lot of these things, the daily normal citizen hopefully will have some space for relief or what Supreme Court Justice called a breathing space to survive.
And I don't think I'd be adequately doing my job, John, if I didn't ask a very obvious and ridiculous question, but tell people why they should not use free Wi-Fi.
Oh, my goodness. And I have friends who are hackers who do this.
Oh, really?
It was really interesting. There was this one thing that Google in 2013, they had a problem with their authentication of Gmail. So anybody who's using a coffee shop Wi-Fi to log into Google, which ostensibly is secure, there's HTTPS, and everything says that it's secure, that this friend of mine was able to pull packets through sniffing and then eventually log on to anybody's email. So if you're... There's a scholar called Wendy Chun who talks about how Wi-Fi is a very promiscuous technology because when you log on to any Wi-Fi, you're really giving every information, piece of information of your computer, anything you're searching for, up to that Wi-Fi. So it's kind of like going to the bathroom in a big room with everybody else.
So essentially, anyone who's a hacker can just log into that Wi-Fi database and just find your footprint. And from there on, do you have to still be logged on to get that information or once it's just stored there temporarily?
It's rarely stored on the actual router itself, but who knows if you can install a piece of software in the router that would save everything and you come back every 6 months and collect it.
Wow. Scary times, my friend. Scary times. And lastly, I was reading recently, and this may be a little bit outside your purview, but again, it's very, very simple information that they recommend that you should always cover your camera with a piece of tape.
Yes. So two things. That came from the Snowden documents that showed that the NSA were often watching cameras for just perverted, you know, voyeurism sense, but also if they were trying to track somebody.
Oh, is that Bill O'Reilly's computer?
Probably, right? But honestly, it's one of these things that it's not necessarily the state that you have to be worried about. It's the fact that any individual could potentially have access to that, and then they could blackmail you or they could, you know, embarrass you. And so the reason this hit home for me is a very disturbing episode of the show Black Mirror on Netflix.
Yes, great movie.
And there is a episode in that shows, and I don't want to give it away to anybody, shows just the real reason why privacy is important, as well as the reason why privacy is a problematic concept as well, because it protects people from doing bad things.
John Chaney Lippold, his new book is We Are Data, Algorithms, and the Making of Digital Selves. And the imprint is what, John? The publisher imprint?
I do not know the publisher vocabulary. It's NYU Press.
NYU Press. Hey, right around the corner from us. John, thank you so much. Do you have a website as well?
It's just nyupress.org, and then We Are Data.
Thank you so much for your time. And we look forward to hopefully a less scary future with our footprints. Have a great day, John.
You too. Have a very good one, too. Bye-bye.
My name is Mark Farrell. We've got a few minutes left in the show, and I want to talk about Bill O'Reilly. So Bill has been released from his job, his coveted job that he's had for well over a decade, the number one rated talk show host on cable. I mean, incredible amounts of money he's earned for himself and equally for Fox. He really put Fox on the map back in, I think it was, 94, 95? Just incredible. You know, you really don't have to like him to understand the power that this gentleman has in front of the camera and off the camera because, as you've heard and read, his way of harassing women has been, I guess, pretty historic with his tenure at Fox. And so we've been learning that throughout the years, Fox has paid off millions to employees of Fox, colleagues of Mr. O'Reilly's, etc. And he went on a so-called vacation recently because more and more advertisers, sponsors were pulling out, understandably. And I get that because the advertisers don't want to be associated with a network who has a misogynist and or a stalker named Trump. I mean O'Reilly working for them. But more importantly, I raised this issue and we talked about this about 2 weeks ago on the show. That his lewd behavior, his hypocrisy, especially with his new book, I forget the main title, Old School, and then his slug line is No Means No, what and how he was doing this to women. And a few of them have come forward. A few of them, one of them in particular, I believe her first name is Nancy. I don't recall her last name at the moment, but doesn't want to litigate. She just wants this to be public information. So obviously she's very happy with the outcome. I'm sure that Bill has lost his very, very cushy gig and that it doesn't happen to another woman. And more importantly, I find it very, very commendable. And I'm so glad this has happened. I'm sure it was not hard that Fox really, really could not sweep this underneath the carpet any longer because the women employees, executives from mid-level to very, very high level spoke up. And so they just can't be a part of this anymore. They can't tolerate this. And so I would imagine there would be a major, major change of chairs on the Fox ship if they did not oust Mr. O'Reilly. And believe me, maybe it's also going to save them a lot of money because the incurred loss of advertisers walking away. I forget the gentleman's show. He's a pretty big, highly rated, number third or number fourth highly rated show on Fox. He's going to be taking the O'Reilly Factor Hour. You know, those bounce back. I don't feel sorry for Fox at all. They did the right thing. They actually probably should have done this sooner. But of course, Bill O'Reilly is their golden boy. And it is what it is. But so long, Mr. Bill O'Reilly. We'll see you in a couple of years. I'm sure you'll be writing a book or two. Maybe you'll be changing some of those titles. Maybe he'll start a nonprofit or give lots of money to women's organizations. You know, he'll reinvent himself and he'll be back on another cable channel. Right. Of course. So finally, I want to talk about someone who is very close to me. My brother, Mike Farrell, he was the second of five Farrell children. And unfortunately, he died by suicide in 1992. So if you're a listener, frequent listener to the show, you've heard me speak about mental illness, mental health, how my brother suffered from depression. And he had a very short window of like 3 months where he was clinically depressed. And unfortunately, he took his life. And then obviously our whole world was turned upside down. And his the day he took his life is on February 24th, and that was 1992. It's a very, very ambivalent day because some years it's not terrible because it's been 25 years. And then some years it hits you like a ton of bricks because it's like it never, ever went away. The wound is still there, and it feels like it just happened a day or so ago. But today happens to be his birthday. And on his birthday, I feel not as sad or crestfallen. I just feel like, you know, certainly I wish he was here. He was my big brother. He was a lawyer. He was a good son, a role model, just a great guy. And so on a day like this, especially, he loved New York. He loved the city and everything about it. He loved the radio station I worked for, went to every event, and just really embraced me as his younger brother. And I certainly looked up to him big time. So we're going to finish the show today with a song that he really, and a musician that he really, really adored. And that's going to be take us out in the show today. So we want to play Billy Joel's New York State of Mind. I thank you for listening to today's show. And if you missed any part of it, of course, you can log on to BRN.FM under Insights. My name is Mark Farrell. Special thanks to, of course, Kelsey at the controls and Jesse, program director, and to our special guest, John. Have a great day. My name is Mark Farrell. Enjoy. And happy birthday, Mike.
I'm in a New York state of mind. I've seen all the movie stars in their fancy cars and their limousines. Been high in the Rockies, under the evergreens. I know what I'm needing. I don't want to waste more time. I'm in a New York state of mind. It was so easy living day by day. Out of touch with the rhythm and blues. The Daily News. It comes down to reality, and it's fine with me, 'cause I've let it slide. Don't care if it's Chinatown or around Riverside. I don't have any reason left them all behind. I'm in a New York state of mind.